It's truly a great pleasure to welcome Susanna Melke to WFMT, or at least to the WFMT airwaves, as we're speaking with her in the basement, or they call it backstage, at Orchestra Hall in a nice little dressing room here. It's such a pleasure because those of you who follow music around the world or follow conductors around the world know that Susanna Melke is really one of the figures of today in terms of both leading orchestras now and leading orchestras who are willing to or particularly interested in contemporary music. And for whatever reason, it took a while for Chicago and Susanna to connect, but 2 years ago they did with a wonderful program of Charles Ives, Richard Strauss, and Thea Musgrave, a concerto for bass clarinet. And now you're back. We're speaking after your first three quarters of a concert because you were on the Afterwork Masterwork series. But again, you have a kind of similar setup in that you have a contemporary work of we'll talk about. You have a modern work, and then you have a couple of other works that are kind of proto-modern maybe. Welcome. Welcome to Chicago.
Thank you
Welcome
so much.
Back.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit, let's start from the programs, and then we'll go back and talk some more about you, if that's okay. Tell us a bit about how you put a program together.
Well, it's always a very interesting process. It varies, of course, depending on the circumstances or the partners. Sometimes the program is suggested by the orchestra, and then it's either take it or leave it. Or sometimes I'm asked about what I would like to do. And in this case, it was one of the more luxurious options. We were discussing with Martha Gilmer and Nick Winter about the kind of program we would like to do.
These are the leaders of the artistic department here.
Yes, and we had both parties. We had this idea that it would be nice to bring something French to the picture because I've been spending a lot of time in France, and it seemed natural. So that was the starting point of the discussion. Mm. And after some research, we found out actually that it would be possible to do Debussy La Mer, which is of course one of the big masterpieces of the beginning of the 20th century. And then it went on, you know. Step by step, we were discussing what would be working well with it. And now,
I should say, Susanna Melke is moving her hands and like gears coming together. And when you see her conduct, she moves her hands and her arms, not in any kind of excessive way, but in a very communicative way that is lost momentarily here on radio.
Well, you know, maybe, yes, my hands are putting the pieces of the puzzle together.
Yeah.
Because making programs is always a little bit of a puzzle, and I also like to approach it to in a way like composing a menu when you eat in a restaurant. You need an appetizer, and then you have the main course or dessert, whatever. It can be seen in very different ways, but yes, in any case, these pieces of the puzzle came together very beautifully, I think. And in the end, even if on paper you might think that this program consists of a little bit of everything, it's not really the case, because
right.
I think there is definitely a red thread through it. And we have the sort of dominance of the early 20th century. And then the modern work, which is by Thomas Addis, is very much connected to the, you know, traditional virtues of writing for symphony orchestra. So I think it makes
and
a very nice.
And then you had the Stravinsky.
That's
in between.
Exactly. Then along the way also, I mean, it's very typical in these discussions, we have a soloist. We were very, very happy to discover that Lila Yosefovich was available to play this week. And she plays Stravinsky fantastically.
Absolutely.
I mean, her interpretation is, I think, exceptional of this piece, because many people consider Stravinsky as sort of strict intellectual, and she's really bringing out all the joy and humor, of which there is a lot.
You read my review when it's not yet in the paper?
Ah!
Yes, well, no, exactly. I mean, you definitely also all seem to be very much on, it's cliche, but to say on one wavelength. And interesting too, because she was playing this piece recently by coincidence, I guess, in San Francisco, and Thomas Addis was out there with another piece, and then the two of them arrive here, and you're all working together. So some of that maybe is because of a shared outlook, but also I think it's because sometimes it happens with these works that became canonical very quickly. They are about X. Well, wait, 50 years ago, you pick up a score the way you would pick up Beethoven or something. You say, well, what is it about? You don't start with the, it is about X, right? And I found the Stravinsky Violin Concerto in D was just opened up in ways I hadn't heard it before.
Totally. I so agree. But I think, I mean, Stravinsky is partly guilty. Probably probably he meant to step back from all this discussion. He always gave these statements about that there would be no feelings in music, it's just notes. And of course, there are plenty of feelings written in the music, but he just didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really, you know, a courageous interpretation of Lila. She hears the music as she does, and I fully agree. Because there are so many different references and characters to all directions in this piece, and well, let's not forget that it's also, which you don't actually perceive when she's playing it, because she's so at ease with it. But it's the fact is that it's horrendously difficult to play, and there are very, very few violinists who actually can see to the other side of the difficulty and find the joy in all this acrobacy, because it's just impossible, but she masters it.
When you look back at people who have played the piece and played it more than once, it basically seems to fall into very young players who sadly perhaps were not heard from much again, or total virtuosos who are looking for one or two different things from the basic works that they play. And we need to have more very fine people across the areas playing this type of repertoire, and certainly Lila will play anything and can, right?
Exactly. And she has a very broad view of the repertory, because she's been playing all the classics, of course, already very young, as we know, and she has been working with contemporary composers very actively in the last years, so she really has the perspective.
It was clear from all three pieces, and the Addis piece is his first large orchestral work from 20 years ago. He's all of 42 now, but he wrote that when he was quite young. And but All Shall Be Well, Opus 10, the line coming from Little Gidding, the last of Eliot's four quartets. It's very clear to these ears, at least, that you're really wanting the audience to listen, which, of course, we always want to listen at a concert, but to kind of quiet down and listen to these soft sounds. And then we found ourselves listening to those same kinds of sounds in the Stravinsky and in the Debussy, even though the Debussy came at the end. But it's, you were saying, it's also kind of the motor of the program. So and I guess from your nodding and smiling that that's what you were hoping.
Well, or exactly. You're not upset. I want to say that I'm extremely pleased if it worked out, because that's how it was thought out to be. But I think the Thomas Addis piece, which we opened the concert with, is exquisite, and it's very, very fine. And he was actually, since we had the pleasure of having him present, he was telling about the piece, that the piece he had written just before, which is Living Toys, which is for ensemble, it's very virtuosic and very sort of explosive. He was saying that he was showing off with that piece. And then when he decided to write the first orchestral piece, he decided particularly not to do that with this piece. So it was written to be an intimate one, also actually written in memory of his grandfather. So there is this very tender message in it, and I was so happy to work with the orchestra on it, because we could find all these pianissimos which worked so beautifully.
They had some good experience over the last month in playing pianissimis in pieces that are also extremely loud, because they had a lot of Verdi with Mr. Muzzi for the last month. And it probably tunes the engine well, right?
Absolutely. Well, music also, like every art, it's about contrasts. Mm-hmm. And of course, the loud ones are even more affected when you have the quiet edge of the meter as well.
Now, we haven't had a chance to hear the work that you will include and open with on Saturday, and If you're listening to this on Monday, you have one more chance on Tuesday, October 19th. And unless you are roughly 78 years old or older, you haven't heard it live at the Chicago Symphony before, because it was only played in 1946. And this is Sibelius's first suite from one of his last works, the Opus 109, the incidental music for Shakespeare's The Tempest. We obviously come to one of those things that you know you will have to be asked about, and that's Finland and music. Sibelius has returned, really, to international heights, and people love playing him, they love hearing him, yet there are still works that somehow remain less played here. I'm curious if you could say something about it.
Well, I mean, of course, as a Finnish person, maybe I should say that the Sibelius is really a source of inspiration and even sort of pride, because we are a small nation and we have this incredible genius in our cultural heritage, and it and the musical language is something that I can't even really intellectually talk about, because it's so close to, you know, it rings some bells which I can't really explain. But I think Sibelius was much more radical than many people yet understand.
Right.
There are these works which are very well known, like the symphonies number 1 and 2, maybe even number 5, Finlandia, of course. But then there are some odd ones, like Tapiola, which is the last orchestral work,
right,
after the 7th symphony, 4th symphony, which is extraordinary. And I think The Tempest is a bizarre example, because it's a late piece, and it has the really, really experimental, radical color in the storm, in the movement of the storm, which is totally contemporary, mind-blowing music. And at the same time, in this suite also, there are quite simple songs.
Yeah.
So he's a writer, he's a composer who actually masters a lot of different styles, and if you don't really know many of his works, you're not necessarily sure where to place him.
Yeah. There was a classical radio station, I can't remember if it was in Chicago or elsewhere, that doesn't exist now, but that used a section of the suite as their theme,
mm-hmm,
their sign-on or their sign-off, back when radio was not 24
really
4 hours. And I think that might have been one of the first times it registered on his music registered on me,
mm-hmm,
as a child. But it's when you say that there is this mystery and this uniqueness, I think that's extremely important, because people got caught up for a long time in this real or imagined division of tonal or atonal or modern or old fashioned. He doesn't fit into any of those
I so
categories.
Agree with you. And I think the interesting story about the music of 20th centuries is exactly that. I personally feel very, very drawn to composers like him, or to Janáček or,
mm-hmm,
Bartók,
mm-hmm,
who created their own language kind of aside of the theoretical analysis of music. And
interesting, isn't it, that many of these people, all three that you mentioned there and a number of others, came from these kind of marginalized countries, small countries. They didn't have, quote, the chance to participate in some of these big Berlin, Paris, New York, London debates, perhaps?
Well, yeah, either not the chance or they felt free from it.
Yes, I meant it with a little sarcasm.
No.
Yeah.
No, I understand, but I think you're absolutely right. It's not necessarily a bad thing to be an observer,
mm-hmm,
rather than being in the center
of things. And Sibelius was very aware of music all around him and of musicians. And he was conducting, he was listening to the radio even after his very long retirement. I mean,
absolutely,
he was in touch in that way.
Yeah. Yes, and the Finnish musical life, I mean, there were connections mainly to Germany, but there,
mm-hmm,
were musicians who came. I mean, Busoni was in Finland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were these connections. As you said, radio was very, very important. It's very interesting. But I think also even today, I think composers, in order to preserve their own visionary language, need to be able to shut off influences.
Right.
Somehow, I think it probably has to do with all art. You know,
yeah,
if you have very, very special individual or I'm searching for words a little bit here, but originality mm-hmm. is always separated from the mainstream.
Right.
That's what I mean, I think.
We're speaking with an original, Susanna Melki. It's spelled, now, do you say that it's an umlaut over the A? But what do you call it in Finnish when you have the dots?
We call it an Ä.
An Ä.
Yeah,
so,
well, so
M-A-L-K-K-I.
That's right, yes. A without the dots, it would be A for us.
Right.
And when you put the umlaut, it's actually the same sound as you have in German, Bärenreiter. So. Mm-hmm.
Does the name come from something, Melki?
Melki is actually a name of a small village, which was at the time, well, it's now on the Soviet, or, well, it was lost to the Soviet during the war, but the Russian side, it's not belonging to Finland anymore. And,
yes.
And the sort of very distant relatives of my father's family come from there. So
okay.
Half of my roots come from Karelia.
Aha, and Karelia, of course, is extremely important to the self-identification of the Finnish people and the legends, and then back to Mr. Sibelius, who comes and animates these through music, as some of his contemporaries did through mural painting and
That's right.
children's book illustration and so on. So he's working with this stock of mm-hmm. of archetypes and myths and so on, and yet he's translating them into the late 19th and, well, really into the early 20th century. And that's a part of that. And then this country recognizes, hey, our big guy is a musician and is a composer, and you wind up with the Sibelius Academy, and 5.4 million now, so probably what, in Sibelius's time, 2.5 million, if that, in the country? And yet, conductors, composers, basses, you generate a lot of musical talent for a country that population is smaller than the Chicago area. We have nothing.
I would say you have nothing. You have the best orchestra of the world in the city, so that's not bad.
I think
I've been asked this question, of course, many times. For example, in France, where I live now since a few years back, why is music so special to Finns? And whereas France, for example, is a country of literature, and they also have a fantastic musical tradition, as mm-hmm. we know. But mm-hmm. but the main culture for the country is maybe in the literature. Whereas music was very important, especially at Sibelius's time. As you know, it was a sort of unifying force between
right.
in a nation where there were two languages
Swedish
battling
and Finnish,
exactly, and Sibelius was belonging to both and actually united. There was this question of independence and all that. But I think, I mean, it's so easy to fall into clichés when you talk about this, but I suppose what we have is very, very search of sincerity mm-hmm. in the music. Mm-hmm. Somehow we relate to it in a way which is maybe different. I don't know. As I said to you, if I speak about Sibelius, it's very difficult to really analyze it, because it's something that I've heard from my very, very earliest childhood,
right.
you know, and this mood in the music, and there is a deep melancholy also. I mean, mm-hmm. if you hear something like Tuonela's Swan when you're 2 years old, it affects you
sure.
in a way which is difficult to explain.
I can see that you're still feeling that.
Yeah.
Effect. Now, you were a cellist.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. So maybe it sent you a message, right?
Maybe, yeah.
You're describing a situation where there is a fertile soil for engaging with young people who want to speak musically. You need some people, though, who shepherd that and are the farmers, you could say. And you've had some amazing teachers who've risen up in Finland and created really schools of teaching. Maybe you could say something about one or more of your teachers.
Well, I think you're probably referring to conducting, mm-hmm. especially.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you're absolutely right. There is this great pedagogue who has been the professor at the Sibelius Academy for decades in conducting, and his name is Jorma Panula. And he's been the teacher of more or less all the conductors you know from the sort of later generations. And that's a very, very big influence. And
so we're speaking of people such as Salonen, Venska,
Saraste, Oramo,
yeah. right? All these
all
names
us,
that we
yeah.
always see now,
mm.
Which is great because they each bring something. You each bring something individual as well as what was the emphasis? What is the Is there a course? Is it a more of a psychological direction?
I think it's a combination of many things. The way Panula had organized the teaching of conducting was very clever, because he established a system of a small orchestra that we could work with. And that didn't exist at the time in other places. I think nowadays there are these academies and people can work. But it was some kind of a laboratory for us. Because there are only so many new things you can talk about in terms of technique, but then you have to get into practice. So that was one thing. The other thing is that he introduced the video, you know, filming. So that he would film us when we were in front of orchestras, and then we would watch the video together. Because of course, like in any communication, you think that you're something, but you're not necessarily doing it. So that was a very good way. And I think the most important thing, which he was very, very clever with. I mean, I'm speaking in past terms because he's retired now. He's still teaching privately. But he actually established a repertory, which we, I think, all went through. There were certain cornerstone works which confronted with different technical problems of conducting.
Mm-hmm. Such as
Sibelius symphonies, for example, because they are really complex in many ways. I think the sort of pieces of the Germanic traditions are written in a different ways, whereas Sibelius' symphonies demand a very different sort of 3D approach to tempi and everything like this. But then, of course, there are also some overtures of the classical repertory. Anyway, you know, you discover different problems with different pieces. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was very clever. And maybe I could add one more thing. Even if he, sometimes people talk about Panula as a maker of maestros or something like that, it was everything but, because he was always really against all this maestro cult. And, you know, he would tell us off immediately if we would have, you know, do some extravagant movements and showing off. He was so against that. And it was just purely everything coming from the score. You had to know what you wanted to do, etc. So it was a fantastic school, and I'm extremely happy to have gone through that.
It's a fascinating thing. In each field within music, there often are one or two of these pedagogues. The old word really applies, because of course they have skills themselves, but they either chose not to or didn't have the right set of skills to be a full-time concertizer. And yet they know exactly what to bring out to make someone or help the person make him or herself a pianist, a violinist, or in his case, something really newer to happen. And maybe in part because of technology being able to assist. Because they always used to say, oh, you can't be taught conducting, but somehow you can be taught violin, you can be taught oboe, you can be taught piano. So
yes, but I think conducting is different, because it's really so much about problem solving, and you have to have a vision. I mean, I think in some ways, to a certain extent, you can be learning instrumental skills by imitating, and you know, there are certain things, and in conducting as well, you need to have a good technique. And he was, you know, there were things that had to be done clearly. But then in conducting, it's a little bit different still, because you have to have a clear vision of things. You have to be able to work with people. You know, it's larger, because
and
you're
you have to communicate all of these
exactly
things.
Exactly,
and
a group of people is actually your instrument. So you can't really. I mean, you have to be able to cope with that. I would say it's a very, very complex matter. And what was interesting, and why I found this time at the conducting class very, very fulfilling, was that he was actually the first teacher in music that I ever had who asked me what I wanted to do. And then if I would be able to say what I wanted to do, then he would be able to help me and say, well, in this case, you have to do da 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 da. If I would not be able to say what I wanted, then he would just indicate, well, too bad, you know, because if you're standing in front of people, you have to have an idea. And in a way, it becomes, you know, this is related to all sort of great Asian wisdom of teaching, that right. in a way the professor has to make himself unnecessary, you know, right. the student understands.
I don't know if you ever worked at all with or professionally crossed paths with Mr. Heitink, Bernard Heitink. But
of course I know there, who
there,
he is.
Right,
yes.
But there's a similar quality. He doesn't like to talk. He doesn't like to teach formally, but especially in later years, more and more people would like a master class or something. And he reduces himself. But by that, he communicates to the conductor, as he likes to say when people get up and start talking, he says, "Hey, Mr. So-and-so, when will you be speaking during the concert?"
Right.
So it's sometimes these things are small, but they get into us and stay in us as a constant goad or reminder of certain things.
Yeah. Well, in any case, you know, people joke about this profession. I mean, of course, it's kind of mystified, and there are all kinds of things that can be said. But there is also the joke that orchestra musicians like very much. They say that the best conductors are all either very old or dead.
Right. You know? These are their favorites.
Exactly. So in any case, it will take decades.
Right.
Well,
you have not reached either of those points, fortunately. And you, as you said, it's decades hence. A number of people will associate your name with the Ensemble Intercontemporain, and you were the music director there for the last several years.
Maybe 7 years.
Seven years.
Yes.
Oh, 2006. Okay, so
time flies.
Yeah. Time flies. That could be an entire discussion or series, but maybe a few thoughts about your time with them.
Well, it was fantastic. It was really a musical adventure in so many ways, and of course a great honor to be in charge of an ensemble of that, you know, importance, because in contemporary music world it's really considered as one of the most important ones.
Absolutely.
And it's been founded by Pierre Boulez in 1976, and I mean Pierre Boulez has a beautiful connection with the Chicago Symphony as well, and I think it's very much thanks to that I was initially you know, that I came here, and having been able to get to know him and discuss with him and collaborate with him already is a fantastic
right.
privilege. And then all these meetings with composers of different generations, I love the collaboration. It you know, of course you work with score, you know, the composer puts all the information in on the paper and then we have to be able to read it, but then in addition to be able to discuss with the composers what they want or what they would prefer and this kind of things, it's so enriching and absolutely fascinating, and this is the kind of work that I want to continue, even if mm-hmm. I'm not going to be there now in this position. But
and there is this kind of double-barreled vision, which is what you've been talking about in your own programming. One, always looking for something new and finding out what's going on, and not necessarily one trend, but what's the best in each of these areas. And two, going back to the building blocks of the modern sound and approaching them in fresh ways and learning from them in new ways. And that's a great combination, rather than only being a museum or only being what was written in the last 2 weeks.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I think some of the contemporary music world has become so, I don't know, do you use the word niche?
Sure.
That it becomes so close an environment that it's actually not communicating with the past anymore. And yet the history of Western music is several hundred years old. And I think the best and most interesting composers are those who actually are able to combine, you know, add something to the chain of the works. And of course it's increasingly difficult because so many fantastic things have already been written.
Right.
But at the same time, you need to master, you have to have the métier, as Boulez would say, you know, the skills of a composer, and you can learn so much from the masters.
Yes.
So and I think also for the listeners, hearing maybe familiar things in a new context can open your ears. And I think also if the contemporary music is too ghettoed, it's not reaching wider audiences. Right. So there are many things, of course, connected.
Well, with an advocate such as yourself, I mean, I think we can see more audiences because you present it in such an alive fashion, and I think you also have a certain magnetism that involves both the audience and the players. And
Thank you very much.
I thank whoever created your magnetism. I'm just observing it. I there's so many other topics, and I hope this will be the first of over the years of a series of conversations we can have. But I thought maybe just briefly at the end if you could say something about opera, because not only do you conduct opera, but you also conduct contemporary opera, which something people say, what is contemporary opera?
Well, yes, what is contemporary opera? You would need to ask 15 composers, and then you would make a series of programs with that. Oh, opera for me, it's something that I have the wish to do more of. I've already done some, as you say, traditional and contemporary. Mm-hmm. And what really fascinates me about opera is the presence. The first thing is the presence of text, the combination of text and music, which is, of course, existing already in all vocal repertory. But then in opera, you have the element of theater as well, mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. element of drama, and then the visual part, you know, the mise-en-scène, the stage design. There's so many elements, and of course it means that there are more risks. But when things click, when it works well, it's the best thing that exists. Mm-hmm. Really.
Do you have something coming up?
Well, I just did the Makropoulos case in Paris Opera before coming here.
Yeah.
And my next opera project will be in Helsinki with the Finnish National Opera. I'm going, this has been a long time dream, and I'm so happy that it's going to be reality. I'm going to do Figaro's, The Marriage of Figaro mm-hmm. of Mozart mm-hmm. next summer. And that's one of the masterpieces. I mean, for me, piece is a pearl because it's perfect as a piece of theater already. And then, as we know, Mozart knew what he was doing. And it's my favorite of Mozart operas, at least for the moment.
And that will be exciting to see, too, for those who are working with you and following you, that Malky does Mozart. You know?
Well, yes, but I've been, it might sound new.
Of course you have been.
But I have been doing it for, yeah.
But to take all of these experiences and focus them on a masterwork, and then to have it focusing on you, as I know it will be a dialogue between you and Mozart and De Ponte. So,
yes, that's
or
right.
Trialogue.
Well, I mean, I would be very honored to be, you know, in this company. I mean, these are really amazing stories, which are still, I mean, even, well, De Ponte and Beaumarchais, most of all, you know, and this play was radical at the time, and it's still radical.
Susanna Malky, stay radical and stay craftsmanlike and stay focused and stay charismatic. And we look forward.
That's so kind of you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We look forward to your next visit. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Music that we heard tonight, all conducted by our guest, Susanna Malki, and all by a contemporary Finnish composer, less known outside of Finland than a number of other Finnish contemporary composers. He's about 65, and his name is Jukka Tiensuu, T-I-E-N-S-U-U. He's also, believe it or not, which actually does make sense when you hear his music, a harpsichordist as well as a contemporary composer. We opened with the first movement, Introduzione, of Spiriti, a five-movement accordion concerto written in 2005. And midway through our conversation with Ms. Malki, we heard the fifth movement, Scatto Finale of Spiriti by Tiensuu. And the accordionist was none other than Mikko Luoma. And we went out with a full work, 18-minute work, the Clarinet Concerto Puro, Pure, Purity, 1989, with the more well-known Finnish clarinetist Kari Kriikku, the Avanti Chamber Orchestra, the 2008 release on the Finnish Alba label, available in the SACD format for those of you who follow such things. Ms. Malki also has recordings on the Bis label and on the Kairos label, Nordic stuff, Ensemble Anticontemporain stuff, and other things on other Finnish labels. If you're listening to our initial broadcast, you have one more chance this season to hear Susanna Malki in music of Sibelius, Thomas Addes, Stravinsky with Lila Josefowitz violin, and Debussy, and that's Tuesday the 22nd, 7:30 p.m. We'd like to thank Rochelle Rowe of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association for helping us to organize this interview, Edward Ingold for recording the interview for us, Matt DeStefano for putting it all together with me and making it sound great, our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. You can hear this or any of our programs again anytime, WFMT.com/criticalthinking for the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I think we'll start up some kind of a Facebook page at some point. We all have Facebook pages, and WFMT has one. But for now, you want to reach us, email is great. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.